what you want is what you need. So what you want, you need it, this is Hello, everyone. You are listening to CKUT 90.3 FM, CKUT.ca on the web, and this is Gay and Grey Live. I'm going to turn the mic over now to David from Gay and Grey Montreal for today's episode. David.
Thank you very much. I welcome everyone who's listening. It's great to have you here and to share information with you. We're going to talk about a project at Gay and Grey, which is destined to help the Anglophone speaking community across the province. But first, we have to begin to surface information. So this project is designed to test what's available and how responsive it is. So maybe, Andrea, maybe you can describe the project and the importance it is to the queer Anglophone community.
Absolutely. Thank you, David, and thanks for inviting me onto the radio show today. So my name's Andrea Palmer, pronouns she, her, and I'm the project lead for this Gay and Grey project called Q11, Creating Links to Care for 2S LGBTQIA+, Older English-Speaking Adults in Quebec. So ultimately, the project, the goal of the project is to build a network of care for, as I mentioned, 2S LGBTQIA plus older adults. This project came about from, before I joined, from identifying a clear need that it's difficult to access health and social services in English in Quebec that understand the unique experiences of aging 2S LGBTQIA plus adults. So the population is definitely underserved. And we're building a network of community organizations and service providers across the province with the goal, the ultimate goal of creating an online directory and clear access points to health and social care resources that are understanding of the diverse needs of this population. So the Q11 project, which if you think of like 311 or 811, aims to reduce barriers to health and social support. It aims to break down isolation and exclusion and to promote the physical, mental, and emotional well-being of 2S LGBTQIA plus English-speaking older adults. We're hoping to build a sustainable network of care. And it's important to note we're just in phase one of the project. So it's a one-year project culminating at the end of March 2024 in this large database and hopefully ultimately a phone number that would then be implemented in a phase two of the project, depending on funding, where there would be a phone number in each of the 18 health regions, and someone could call and connect with another person on the end of the line who can help them refer them to specific services based on the information that we've identified and according to their own needs.
What kind of problems are you running into gathering the information?
In terms of, I guess, challenges, I think it's just that it's a far-reaching project. So there are 18 health regions, and you know, we're wanting to make sure that we are checking like four of, hopefully multiple, but hopefully at least four, one of the following four boxes. So it'd be good if there was some overlap, thinking intersectionally, but LGBTQIA plus informed or specific services, queer and trans focused organizations, culturally informed or safe organizations and services. So thinking about organizations that serve two-spirited folks, Indigiqueers and Indigenous populations, or services serving Black communities and communities of color, refugees and migrants and new arrivals, and also services that are older adult informed. So the services that understand the unique and wide-ranging needs of aging. Specialists in gerontology are hard to come by. And finally, in Quebec, English-speaking and bilingual services. And that's been something that at least I'll speak about a little bit later, but in Gaspésie, there's definitely a lot of open bilingual positions, but not many of them are filled. So I guess one of the challenges would be in some of the regions, especially for our population being minority Anglophone or English-speaking, to ensure that there are services that have these are informed about these unique needs and also offer services in English for those who might not be able to navigate the healthcare system in French.
Considering Bill 96 and the government's position on delivering services in English, how are you finding that piece of legislation helping or hindering your attempts to gather and deal with organizations which are maybe limited how they are able to respond?
Yeah, so we've already been hearing anecdotally in terms of people, so service users having a hard time accessing services in English, and then being, you know, we've heard about it in the news as well in terms of being denied service in English. But it's interesting because in, you know, going into the regions, you know, having the Bill 96 and the caveat that they that healthcare should not be affected. The caveat is that if those services are available. So a big challenge is that those services may not be offered if they are not available. And then in terms of advertising service, that becomes a challenge as well. So patient navigators, for example, who are helping, and those are people who actually work in Quebec, and they have patient navigators in Ontario and other provinces as well. So they serve the minority language population in whichever province. So here it would be English speakers, and in Ontario it would be the French speakers. But in terms of advertising their services, they cannot provide... they can't really put posters unless it's in a hospital setting. They can't put them in community. And I've heard that if they were to put them in French, it wouldn't really be useful because the folks who need those wouldn't then be able to understand the service that's being advertised.
Have you run into resistance from organizations to give services in English?
No, actually. To be honest, I haven't yet. Maybe it's because... I mean, generally, I find, like, you know, what's interesting, and these are some of the conversations I've been having, is that in Quebec, you know, when we're on the front line and service workers themselves are, as far as I've encountered in this project, are often wanting to meet people where they're at. And so if I have, you know, if your, you know, French is stronger than your English and my English is stronger than your French, but we can understand each other, then you might speak French and I'll speak English and we can still kind of work together. So on that side, I've only really met people who are enthusiastic to provide services to as many people as possible. Although I can't speak to being on the front lines and doing that long work of, I've heard in terms of, within hospital settings of really helping to, you know, encourage folks who may feel, you know, alienated by a language that they don't understand, or, you know, that might, those feelings could come up, but ultimately I've really, it's been quite positive on that front. So it's interesting when the law is coming into play and that when those of us, or at least the service providers, because this is more of a systemic level project, but the people on the front line are really trying to make do and support people in whichever way they can. And of course, we know that that's not always the case because we are hearing these stories where it becomes a challenge. But for me, so far, it hasn't been that big of an issue.
Part of it is to reaching out into off the island of Montreal into the community, and you went to the Gaspé. How was that like?
That was great. So the Gaspé, and I would say the Baie des Chaleurs region in particular, is really interesting in terms of the model that they have. Something that I think that we could that could be a nice model to look at for other regions. They're fairly well connected in terms of their health system, so the CISSS, and also their community organizations, especially their English advocacy organizations that have been around for 25, 30 years. Perhaps even longer. So there's actually a roundtable on 2SLGBTQIA, like serving 2SLGBTQIA older adults, and quite a few service providers. So when I joined, it was, you know, first of all, there was a community organizer there, shout out to Greg, who has been instrumental in, you know, helping make some of those connections, but ultimately people were really willing to come to the table. So I had folks from the system, the community organizations, and the I would say a research center as well.
So part of the future is to go out from the organizations into the community and speak with gay older people in the community and get their opinions?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's a component that we've built into our project. We're calling them community conversations. We definitely want to hear. So while the primary focus of our project does reach out to organizations, because we're identifying it's kind of a survey of what exists, but we definitely want to hear from the service users and, you know, our target population themselves to hear what are the services where they do go, where they access, where they feel welcomed, where they've had positive experiences, which are the ones maybe that could be improved upon or that they, you know, might avoid. What is a welcoming service, and then what would they need from our network. So I have had a couple of those community conversations. They're not focus groups because this isn't a research project. It's really grounded in community, but we have had a couple of those here in Montreal, and we're hoping to have one later in October in Gaspé after some of the relationship building that we've and outreach we've done so far in that region.
Your experience, although limited, maybe do you have any particular recommendations you can make from what you've garnered over time so far?
So a couple things in terms of what I've learned so far and that I think I would like to highlight. I think there'd be maybe three things so far. So the first would be a few points, a few key points from our members. And so far this has been through our Gay and Grey network. So through the Gay and Grey community at large, as well as the trans and non-binary group that's hosted every second Thursday online. So things that they've mentioned would be welcoming are still having, let's say, the like visual identifiers of the rainbow flag or the inclusive pride flag present in clinics and offices. Basic acknowledgement of existence actually goes a long way. And there was at least one person who said, just like, spell it out, you know, that was a bit loud, but spell it out. We welcome everyone, and we do not tolerate homophobia or transphobia or racism in any kind. So setting a tone in an office can definitely put people at ease. Of course, that doesn't necessarily guarantee that everyone in that space has been trained or is well equipped or well, you know, informed on their needs, but at least it's creating a space, you know, just in the waiting room or how they might be interacting with staff that might make them feel more comfortable. In addition to that, safe forms, so that are more inclusive in terms of gender identity or names. And then also there was a general need and an identification of a request for resources to help navigate grief. So something our society just doesn't do well to begin with is to how we navigate death. And so that's been something that's come up and definitely become a priority in terms of our network and identifying those resources. And also a kind of a home care or some sort of volunteer support network maybe that is known to be queer and trans positive. So, you know, people, as if I quote one of our members, don't want to de-dykeify, you know, their homes when someone is to come by and help with cleaning or maintenance, that kind of thing. And another recommendation, or maybe just something I've learned, I think that's what your question was, is I've learned a lot, and I think it's important to recognize some of the more avoidant reactions. So while for the most part, when I reach out to organizations, I have to say it's been very like overwhelmingly positive, and people have been enthusiastic, wanting to join in, wanting to meet, talk about it. But, you know, how can they help? How can we help each other? Disseminate information, that kind of thing. But there is sort of I've had a couple experiences of noticing, and at one resource fair for older adults in particular, I didn't have as many organizations visit my table as I had hoped. And after I had introduced myself and everything and saying, you know, I'm Andrea with the Q11 Project and this is what it is, and, you know, let's talk. And finally, one woman, she was, you know, working for an org in one of the regions, and she was kind of hesitant, I could tell, to come and talk to me. And finally, she just said, you know, it's great what you're doing, but we don't have anyone who's LGBTQ coming to our organization. And so this is the kind of, you know, it also happened in Gaspé Z, I heard, like in terms of a research project, reaching out to care homes for a free training, nothing to lose, only to gain. And only two care homes really signing on for that. So really, you know, of course, that's just not true. You know, it's if people, it's this ongoing kind of erasure, and it's one of the things that our project is combating by just sort of being present and having those conversations with these people and saying, yeah, you know, that you know of, you know, that you may not know that there's any folks who identify on the 2SLGBTQIA+ identity spectrum, because perhaps you haven't, you know, either it hasn't come up for that person or it hasn't been made welcoming or safe enough for them to disclose that. So that's just definitely been something in terms of recommendations and just the highlighting the importance of just having, you know, whether it's our postcards or, you know, the groups that Gangray are offering, you know, knowing that some folks are in their 60s and they're navigating gender identity exploration for the first time, you know, creating space and just saying, oh, this is something that you could access if you wanted to on your own terms is really important. So I guess in terms of a recommendation, it would really be to kind of have more of an openness to understanding our project and not to jump to conclusions, because we're everywhere. And, you know, it's really important as well in terms of older adults that that they can have and they should have access to, you know, healthy sexuality and expressions of identity as well. And so we want to make sure that that is included and that it doesn't get dismissed when I say, you know, this is for, you know, folks who are, you know, queer or trans and two-spirited, that they would say, oh, okay, you know, maybe I don't know anyone personally, but for let's have a postcard and information present for those whom it might speak to.
Besides the ignorance of organizations not knowing their clientele, have you noticed a difference between community organizations and professional organizations like CLSCs and how they would respond to your situation?
You know, it's interesting because, like, I would say the Gaspésie is a good example where they were kind of, as far as the frontline workers that I've spoken with, all on the same page. I think that's just there's maybe a lot of work that's been done there. But I think it depends on the type of organization. So this is why we want to make sure we reach organizations that, you know, might be, let's say, you know, LGBTQ+ specific or informed, but also the more general centers that are just for all older adults, so seniors or like 65+ or 50+, you know, adult. So that's a wide range of people who access those centers. And I can't speak to like a clear difference because it really depends on the person. But I think it's just what I have heard is it's not even so much as the providers all the time, although this was obviously an example that it does happen with the providers, but sometimes they're worried about their the actual clientele who might not be welcoming or informed either. So then it's a matter I've been invited in to give workshops or or I refer to Gangray in terms of some of the work that you all are doing that's more direct, but yeah, I wouldn't say that I've seen anything distinct that I could say one is, in terms of the type of organization, it's kind of been, I think, maybe the...
But you've noticed that they really don't understand the community which they're serving, and that the gay people, lesbians and others in that community, may not be comfortable about responding to them. And so how is this project going to help them become more open and comfortable about receiving gay and lesbian and trans people into their programs?
Okay, yeah, that's a great question. So for me, I think it's the one-on-one meetings. So, in, you know, having this conversation with this person who I actually, you know, appreciate that she was honest, because then I can understand her hesitance.
Exactly.
And then I can have a follow-up meeting with her and speak one-on-one and then, you know, take that a bit further and then say, would you be willing to disseminate this? Or would you be willing to, you know, I could recommend there's different training programs, you know, Fondation Emergence offers free training programs for service organizations. But I think, again, it's that it's bringing... I always operate from a bringing people in.
Have you run into any workers in those organizations, either community or professional, who are actually gay themselves and feel they've had problems in their workload about trying to reach out to a clientele which the organization may not want to accept?
I haven't had that specific experience expressed to me, although I definitely know it, you know, it exists, and that's, it's very common in terms of the workload being put on, you know, people of certain populations, that they might be the expert of the entire population and that workload would fall on them. But I haven't, I guess, met directly with someone who expressed that, but I know it can be a challenge.
Would this project that you're heading help them in the long run to receive a hidden clientele?
I think it could help if they are willing, you know, if we have the conversation with the project and they understand the need for it, and even maybe they won't be, maybe their organization isn't going to change from our project because it's almost, you know, unfortunately, it's beyond our scope. But if they at least are like, yeah, we could have our the postcards, we could put a poster, we can make it known that this network exists, then at least that gives the freedom of the individuals to access it on their own. I think in terms of that systemic and far-reaching change, this project is really identifying the, like, we unfortunately we're not building something new per se, so we're only identifying what does exist. So for our members, and when we have this database, what we're hoping to be able to do is at least give some informed information about what does exist and how they may or may not you know, be informed at this time.
Do you foresee any particular kind of tools that could be helpful that we could develop to help them?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think having, you know, having organizations, I guess some of the tools, like, do exist in terms of service providers and trainings. I know, again, the Fondation Emergence training that is for service organizations. But I think, you know, it's interesting because it's the willingness to have those individuals partake in them. It's the sort of okay, maybe we will take that training. So I think maybe having this sort of bridge to have a conversation about these needs and that it is an issue is a starting point that I think is really helpful to then direct to those tools. But I haven't, I'm trying to think, just because in terms of where we're at, about halfway through the project, our resources and the recommendations are going to really be geared towards our, you know, our target population. And then on the flip side, there's obviously, of course, the work that needs to be done on the organizational side. But I think directing them and sort of having them invited into a conversation to then say, oh, okay, yeah, we need to do this work because, you know, we were completely, you know, blind to the fact that, you know, these folks are probably in our community and definitely in our community, and we're not offering what we can to them.
Do you foresee at the end of the project in March, you have developed something that's physical and useful that you can give to workers and or clients about taking advantage of the situation that they may not feel comfortable initially, but because of what you've been able to do or open the doors, that they may want to venture across and ask for service?
Yeah, I mean, the tangible thing that we will have is a more, I guess, an accessible report. So something that really, you know, beyond what was kind of required of the project initially, we really want to have a report that contextualizes the history and the need for it, and as well as the progress and the process that we did in this project, so that we can hand that out, you know, to either a resource, to a person, you know, to a member, to anyone who wants to understand, okay, why. And a big thing is I think that why piece, you know, it's something we're working on in our social media now as that becomes more active, is also having that, having just little, you know, we're calling them YQ11 posts. And so having a little bit of context that we can put out, a little bit of education that's coupled with highlighting organizations that exist and that are doing, you know, great work, or key partners, and coming in and offering that support to our older adults. So, yeah, I think that would be the piece, is like, it'll be kind of a pretty report, but something that people could take with them. And then beyond that would be in, the recommendations would be in there. And then hopefully that would also lead us to a phase 2 where we could implement.
In the next couple of months, what sort of initiatives are you doing and where?
Yeah, so in the next week, we have about 6 months left of the project. So we're just kind of finalizing our timeline. It's kind of like 6 months has gone by, and we're at that halfway point, and it's going to go pretty fast. So it really feels like it's ramping up. We've hosted a couple intra-organizational meetings, so as I mentioned, in Gaspésie, but also in Montreal. So we're hoping to have at least two more of those in the Montreal area, where we're bringing together some of the key partners. So Interling is a key one. They are a resource that offers, 24/7 support to us LGBTQIA+ people of all ages. So they're definitely someone in terms of, and they also have programs for older adults and seniors. So if ultimately, this project were to be transferred to anyone, it looks like that they would be they're interested in taking on, kind of filling in some of the gaps they have in terms of the English speaking organizations and also the older adult organizations that serve older adults. So they would ultimately potentially take that on. But to have the space where organizations can come together and may not have otherwise had that time to speak or to collaborate in person has been really useful. And then we also are planning a couple more community conversations. So another a virtual event, for the general population, as well as really reaching out to our Two-Spirited and Indigiqueer community, hearing from them in terms of their needs. That's coming up in November with the guidance of a couple of consultants we've hired onto the project. So I think it's about at least three community conversations, and probably about that of the inter-organizational, and then a lot of those one-on-ones in between where we bring people in.
Well, that sounds very exciting, and thank you for all the work you've been able to do so far. I think you may have a question you want to ask me.
Yeah, well, I think it would be worth hearing from you just to sort of really ground, the need for this project again and contextualize it. And you said you were maybe willing to share some of your own experiences navigating the health and social care system here in Montreal or in Quebec.
I've been working in the social service field for almost 30 years. And I know what it's like to go from, I've gone from when the system was very small and malleable to system now being very controlled, centralized, and more data collecting than service giving kind of organization. I've felt as a gay person, I was given cases that would be appropriate because nobody else was able to. And as an Anglophone person, the same, because most of these organizations, CLSCs and so on, and now especially, are being more and more conducted in French, and the workers are forced to do things in French. And so their ability to do and receive Anglophone clients is now more limited, and some of them are uncomfortable about or not even able, because they don't have a chance to practice the vocabulary or whatever, to allow them to be more receptive. So there is this problem of latching on to somebody who is in a minority situation as a worker and dumping things on them because they're known, as opposed to equipping everybody else to be able to respond. As I'm on the Regional Access Committee for English Social Services on the island, and we have 10 institutions, CLSCs and hospitals and so on, who are being prevented even about putting up simple little things like signs in English to show you where to go. The government, this particular government, is not willing to bend and is trying to find ways to make it more difficult for workers who are able to deal with Anglophone clients but are not given any support in that process. And the other thing that isn't happening is that the workers themselves do not get support on how to deal with some of the caseload amongst themselves. So the support, when I was the AIDS worker at Ville Marie Social Service Center and then the CLSC Metro, and working across the hospitals and other things, we brought people in, all kinds of social workers, physiotherapists, doctors, lawyers, whatever, in order for them to deal with issues like grief, or like the difficulty with government getting in the way of actually giving service and so on. So there's still a major problem for the workers themselves to feel that they not only have support to do what needs to be done, but are recognized by management as being a vital part of the service delivery system. And this is not being tackled. I've retired now, but I've dealing with friends in the system, and I've heard things like people being suspended because they trying to explain to one of their fellow workers why this is inappropriate, and they've been accused of racism and other things in response. So people are reticent or shutting down altogether. So the system is not opening up to be able to respond. And your project, I think, once it tables its recommendations, will give a lot of these workers a tool, which is why I was stressing that earlier, a tool that they can take back into their systems and try to incorporate that in the service delivery. Some places are more responsive than others. And you have to pick and choose. In things that you think are, like the West Island, would be more English and able to respond, sometimes are just the exact opposite. So what you have a visage of how things operate, in reality, there are many problems that are put in the place to prevent people from receiving clients or giving services to clients.
Yeah, that I can definitely speak to and echo, because in terms of, I guess, one of the challenges organizations are facing as a whole, it's always been funding, and it's also always program-dependent funding. So organizations are spending a lot of their time, okay, you just get a program, you know, underway, but that year is up, you know, much like our project, in a few months, and there's no funding to renew this program that is well established and serving community, but we have to re-envision it. And not only that, we're building a network, we're inviting in and identifying a database of services, and I already know of one that I connected with just a few months ago that's closing, an organization in Verdun. They're closing due to lack of funding. So while I had a fantastic meeting, they were really keen, they were doing outreach, they just won't even exist, I guess, any longer. So that is absolutely just an ongoing challenge and really something I don't even know how we can solve that right now.
Part of the problem in the system is the government is so focused on stats, how many people you saw, how many this and how many that and so on, and that you get penalized if you don't do things within a certain amount of time. And the caseload that workers have now is double what I had when I was in the system. So they don't want you to get involved. They want you to do the minimum where you can give a nice little stat and send it in the computer and go on to the next. They don't want you to actually work with somebody. I had one client who was a survivor of the Holocaust, and then she was in Hungary, then she was taken in by the communists. And so when she escaped, she had two specific kinds of trauma forced on her, one by the socialists, communists in that sense, but another by the institutions here not wanting to deal with those issues and just let me deal with surface things like you need somebody to help you clean, but you don't need somebody to actually sit down and listen to what's on your mind. So there is a problem of not being able to work with a client and actually get into their own particular situation so you can help them grow into a more comfortable human being in the long run, which is why this project has such vital importance for the future.
Mm-hmm. I've had that experience having previously worked in frontline and as a social worker, and it's often, I mean, I was lucky enough that in the few jobs that I, you know, when I was in the different jobs that I had, I could spend a little bit more time in terms of one-on-one support, but it was often a referral game. So if you're, if you want to refer someone to, let's say it's from the CLSC or from the child welfare system, they're often able to close their cases by referring into community. But then if community is underfunded and their programs, you know, are continuously trying to find new money for their program renewal, it's a circular game. And it was another thing that came up in terms of from our members is access, you know, of course, to mental health support that is in the system. So in Gaspésie, for example, there's a 2-year wait for a mental health, like a therapist or a psychologist or in English, 2 years, unless you're in active crisis mode. So, I mean, and when you can't refer someone because they don't have the, you know, the financial ability to pay for a private worker, you know, mental health support worker, you feel completely like your hands are tied in terms of trying to offer them the best support that you can.
Or the worker wanting to give but being prevented by the institution not being able to give.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a difficulty in supporting the worker and dealing with their guilt and other sorts of issues that they have, as well as the client not able to get what they need for them to be able to function in the long term. So both the working situation and the client reception situation are not meeting the needs of the clients in general.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's definitely something that we'll be highlighting in a report in terms of, you know, we always want to, you know, we have to try and frame it in the way of like recommendations, but of course those recommendations will be worked into the, into highlighting what is there, what was told to us and what is needed, you know, and that's all, I guess, I mean, you know, that's definitely something we hope to disseminate to our, you know, our key partners on the ground, and also the key partners who have some of that political leverage and power and are working in governments, to sort of say, this is what we've learned, you know, in addition to what we've done and what we've grown in our network, we've also learned that there is a gap. So we can't, you know, if our network has holes in it, we need support with that.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've heard from us and you've heard the kinds of problems that people are having to deal with. This is why this kind of project is so important and why we wanted to make sure that you understood the kinds of issues that we were dealing with and how we're trying to deal with them and the reception in dealing with them. And so if you have any comments or stories that you'd like to share with us, please contact us at gangray.com or on Facebook. We have a Facebook page there. So there's a number of ways for you to get at us. And thank you for this time. You want to make an addition?
Yeah, I'll add that you could also follow the Q11 Quebec project on Instagram and Facebook. And if there's any organizations out there or even members who want to share, you know, their experiences about healthcare, you can email q11quebec@gmail.com.
Thank you so very, very much.
Thank you, David. Listen to you.
KUT
CKUT Radio 90.3 FM in Montreal.
Come back to tough on tour. I'm having flashbacks of us. No clothes with the sex and the weed combo. I need to see you, girl, pronto. Come back to tough on tour. I'm having flashbacks of us. No clothes with the sex and the weed combo.
Bonjour, Montreal. What's going on? It's the R&B Trailblazer K-Force, and I'm just letting you know you can listen to my new song, Thug Passion, from my brand new album, Pray for a Beautiful Sky, right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. And you can go get that on Spotify, Apple Music, and Tidal, man. Let's go. Fway out, baby.
David, I'd like to get your opinion about what's now happening in our society as it relates to trans kids in schools and what the political ramifications could be to our community as a whole.
Well, you know, we having dealt with English issues and gay issues and so on, and we think that we've learned on how to handle those, we come to the trans issues, which we dealt with back in the 70s, and now we deal with it differently. And the reception of people goes from fear, ignorance, support, but mostly it's the ignorance takes over from either the parents or the institution, and leaving the trans person or the non-binary person forcing to fend for him or herself, or themselves, depending on which pronoun that they're using. And the older gay person has had to be re-educated. From back in the 70s when you had transsexuals and so on, we don't use those words anymore. But we have in our headspace, those are the words that are there, and that the pronouns, we have to educate ourselves on what that means. We assume that it's he or she, and things are different. And we have to be able to transmit the difference and help them understand the difference. And there's a lot of ignorance and difficulty or indifference even almost to wanting to grow and so on. People feel, I have enough with my own plate that I don't have time to deal with these other issues. But it's part of what we in the community must make a way for everybody to be part of that community and to be understood and accepted as part of that community. And one of the goals of Gay and Gray, and one of the goals of the Intergenerational Project, which we are attempting to get off the ground as well, is to facilitate people becoming comfortable with diversity and acknowledging that with pride and has a usefulness instead of running in fear and ignorance away from it. So there's a lot of work to be done, but I think we're beginning as an organization just within ourselves to try to deal with some of those issues in a more positive way and a more receptive way, and so that we can accept, regardless of age, somebody's difference in looking at themselves and what they think is gender and how they fit in or not.
With all of the demonstrations that went across Canada, a lot of queer people came out and counter-protested. What's your thought about getting more of the organizations within Quebec to get together and create some kind of a day of strength?
The organizations in Quebec have to begin to accept some leadership in the community. We're not an organized community. We have organizations that do different parts, but we're not an organized community that somebody can speak for the community. So we have to do a much better job amongst talking about each other and arriving at what are some of the common issues that we can tackle together. We haven't had this, unlike other cities. We haven't had a real gay coalition since back in before the trucks raid so many histories ago. So we really have to find a focal point, and a community center is a good place to start with that. And hopefully something like that will get off the ground, will help us give us a focus where different people, trans and non-binary and gay and lesbian and whatever else, can feel that there's a place for them to go and be accepted, and they don't have to define themselves as they go through the door. They just have to go through the door.
Thank you very much, David.
CKUT 90.3 FM. You know you want to.
Montreal, Montreal, are you looking for the most authentic Caribbean meal in the city? Do you need a clean and spacious venue to host your next special event? Are you searching for fresh and delicious meals for your late night crave? Come and visit the Caribbean Food Factory, open 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, for all your dining, pickup, delivery, catering needs. Call 514-481-2444, home of the best jerk chicken in Montreal, for the most authentic fall of the bone oxtail, and now serving Caribbean and Canadian breakfast each and every morning. We are here to serve you fresh and well-seasoned dishes to satisfy your mind and soul. Call 514-481-2444. Again, 514-481-2444. With our original Jamaican ginger beer, sorrel, and original Jamaican patties, with our warm and friendly staff ready to serve you in the most spacious and beautiful environment right here in NDG, 5311 de Maisonneuve West, corner of Dikari. No need to book your flight. You have everything here at the Caribbean Food Factory to bite. Come on down and join us. We're looking forward to seeing you all. 50 years of experience. The Caribbean Food Factory. When you eat here, it's like winning the lottery.
Hey, this is the R-O-X-A-N-N-E, and you are listening to CKUT.
Schemes. You can laugh till your dreams fall apart at the seams, and life gets more exciting with each passing day, and love is either in your heart or on its way.
Good evening, this is Vrisna Kasharo. I am a member of Older Women Live Collective, CKUT 90.3 FM. We produce a radio program every second Wednesday of each month. Greetings to our sisters, Rosemary Wally, Laura Yaros, and Marlene Rateau, who were not able to participate tonight. In the context of colonization and the rise of capitalism, shocking stories have emerged. Tonight,